our time with Uncaged.
Welcome to Topple Uncaged. I'm Steve Topple, and you're locked on to the UK's hottest politics and music podcast. Each week, I bring you the rawest takes on the big stories making the news, always joined by a very special guest. Then, I pleasure your mind, body, and soul with the freshest, most banging international music going.
Uncaged.
What's up, everyone? I am Steve Topple. It is the first full week in May. And yes, I have dedicated a whole 6 days of this podcast to one very special cause.
The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
Because the first full week in May is not only Emmy awareness, but it is millions missing weeks as well. Myalgic encephalomyelitis, commonly referred to as ME, or you may know it as chronic fatigue syndrome, that is CFS, is a chronic, systematic neuroimmune disease. It affects at least 17 million people worldwide, and around 250,000 people in the UK alone, and those figures are just estimates. Symptoms vary for every person, but people with it often experience post-exertional malaise, that is, an array of symptoms brought on by either physical or mental exertion, or both. It quite often feels like having the flu, you experience all-over pain, you have sleep disturbance, problems with your sleep, cognitive impairments. The autonomic systems in the body are often messed up, that includes your nervous system, digestive system, and endocrine, and you experience hypersensitivity. ME has been fraught with controversy. For decades, and let's be honest, often still to this day, the medical profession and systems of government have not properly recognised it. People living with ME have been disbelieved, stigmatised, given incorrect treatment, or, quite often told, it is all in their heads. However, both ME Awareness and Millions Missing Weeks aim to change all this. So, over the course of the next 6 days, I'm going to have some very special guests on my podcast, one a day, giving us some insights into areas of this debilitating disease, which, in my opinion, aren't often talked about enough. So, let's get cracking with today's guest. It is Sunday the 12th of May, and it is of course International Awareness Day for ME, and it is also the culmination of Millions Missing and ME Awareness Week. So on that note, I thought it'd be very fitting to end with, for me, a very exciting guest. He is a trailblazer and quite frankly an inspiration to me in what he does. Unrepenting in his analysis of what has been going on in the medical community with regards to ME. He's absolutely fantastic. I'm so privileged to have him on the show because I follow his work rigorously and he is stupendous. It's very exciting to be able to introduce to you for the podcast, David Tuller. David, thank you so much for taking the time to come and speak to me. It is a treat to have you on, seriously.
Thanks. I'm really happy to be here.
Look, let's get the negative stuff out of the way first. I cannot have you on without discussing, obviously, Pace trial. Now, there was a brilliant picture on Twitter of you that I noticed with this T-shirt where it's the Pace Man, and it's like this little Pac-Man going around, and obviously that piqued in my mind you going up and gobbling up Michael Sharp and Simon Wesley, and I thought it was wonderful. But on a sort of honourable serious note, how much longer do you think that the proponents of what essentially was, in my eyes, scientific fraud, medical and ethical negligence, how much longer do you think the proponents of Pace trial can keep up their protestations saying that it is safe and it is correct and it is the best option out there until their house is completely tumbling down? Because the weight of evidence now is becoming overwhelming. How much longer do you think this is going to continue before it is completely just dead in the water?
Well, that's a difficult question because I'm surprised it's, you know, they've managed this long. I think really it's clear that their insistence is being enabled by the medical and academic hierarchies in the UK and by the journal editors in particular. If the journal editors would do their jobs and actually conduct, you know, authoritative oversight, then we wouldn't be in this situation. So really at this point, you know, the authors, from what I can see, will never acknowledge the mistakes that they've made. If we're talking about Pace specifically, I mean, there's two issues. There's Pace specifically, and then there's the larger cabal or the CBT, GET ideological brigades, as I like to call them, who basically have a higher, you know, an entire thing built on really very, very flimsy evidence. And so there's the question of the people who believe the entire body of evidence and those who still are just defending Pace. So basically, you know, the Pace trial has flaws that everybody else except this group of people and the editors defending them. And apparently, you know, it just recently got sort of a an ethics, you know, kind of approval from the Health Research Authority. There's a lot of reasons why that was a problematic report, and it didn't comment at all on it. First of all, it didn't really, from my perspective, let's just say it was a problematic report. And I think one of the issues is that it was a narrow report. It looked at very specific things and not at the science. And it actually did call for continuing robust discussion of the science. But anyway, I think overall, the UK hierarchy, the Lancet, BMJ, they've sort of, you know, stood around these researchers and defended work, because they published work that really should not have been published. So I think there's, you know, when I kind of started this, I thought, well, if you publish an investigation, really, if you publish what patients had already said, the trial should have been questioned from the beginning. It's just that people weren't listening to the patients. And then I thought, well, if you publish the kind of piece that I wrote initially 3.5 years ago, no trial really would survive that, and that would be the end of Pace. Well, that turned out not to be the case. Then I started organizing the open letters. That started to get some press coverage. Then Alan Matthews had his case come up. And then, you know, I made sure to get one of the open letters out before that so that could be cited in the case. So then the data were released, and then that showed that everything. But there was a whole series of events that actually had to happen before you could really get any traction on the issue. Even once you get traction on the issue, the journals don't care. The editors don't care. They let this garbage just stay in the literature. Now, the truth is, it's hard to quote Pace anymore and not really acknowledge that it's embroiled in controversy. So to some degree, I think, you know, what has happened in the last 3 years is that the trial is no longer kind of just cited as pure evidence. Obviously, the CDC removed it. As Kaiser Permanente in the U.S. has basically just now declared that it's all was all nonsense. You know, they had it wrong. So there's a lot of evidence that at least outside precincts of the UK and maybe, you know, Norway and whatever, it's lost a lot of its relevance. And still in Australia, it has weight. You know, I think they're still holding on. And I think that's the problem with the trial, even though it's been discredited to my perspective sufficiently, say, in the U.S., not sufficiently, but to a degree of officially in the U.S. and elsewhere, you know, it still has a lot of power. To potentially harm people.
No, absolutely. Do you know what fascinates me about this, actually, is that there's a kind of, there's an image, if you like, within the, especially within the public mindset in the UK, especially sort of among more sort of left-wing political circles, that somehow the UK is some kind of lapdog to the US in terms of everything the UK does is at the behest of the United States, etc., etc. But what's fascinating about the situation with Pastrell, and it's a broader kind of narrative generally, actually, that this is a very much a UK thing, although obviously Unum was involved in terms of the fact that I think two of the researchers had involvement with them. It's very much a UK phenomenon, and that also what I've found in my research is that that sort of broadens out into social security more broadly. What the UK tends to do, the US sort of looks to and then uses itself and takes that as a bit of a blueprint. I mean, do you think the UK is going to be sort of the last outpost for this, if you like? And is it, are we going to be the hardest nut to crack in finally burying this?
Is this being the CBT, GET approach to me? Yeah. You know, I don't know. I do think it's significant that, you know, probably, you know, I got many more donations from the UK in my recent crowdfunding than I did from the US, which was the next, you know, number two. So proportionally, I got much more from the UK. I think that's because this is really much more embedded here. It's UK research, and I'm obviously fighting UK people, establishment people who have a hard time with my strategy.
I'd say academic performance art, let's say, as I consider it. So I don't really know. I'm really perplexed that it's really kind of a mass delusion that the Pace trial warrants any kind of serious consideration. Once you point out that they lowered their thresholds to the point where people could be, quote, recovered on the two main thresholds, physical function and fatigue at baseline, it really invalidates the study as a piece of serious literature. Until they can explain how that's possibly credible, what they try to do is say, well, never mind that little problem there. You know, well, of course, you know, whatever, blah, 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 blah. But let's look at our main finding here. You can't do that with research. You actually have to look at the study as a whole. You can't sort of do one thing completely unacceptable on one part and then say, well, we're going to carve out this one little part of our findings that we think is okay. That's what I see them trying to do. Nobody actually cites the recovery paper anymore. They don't really seem to be out claiming for in recovery anymore, even though they made a big deal about it at the time. So I think they're a little bit boxed into a corner from my perspective. They know that the science is really working against them. I think they must know, or some of them must know, or maybe the journals must know that they're making indefensible defenses of bad studies. Or maybe they don't know. I have no idea, really. Actually, I shouldn't say that. I don't know what they know or what they don't know. And I don't really care. You know, I don't really care about the researchers. Or I don't really care about I just really care about, people who are putting research out there that clearly doesn't pass the smell test, you know, and that any first-year epidemiology student who were, epidemiology students now get the PACE study, you know, at Berkeley as something to look at and analyze as a case study of bad science. So, on the one hand, how The Lancet is claiming it's a great study, and my colleagues at Berkeley in epidemiology think it's so bad it needs to be taught as bad science. If I weigh those, I actually believe my colleagues at Berkeley more than I believe The Lancet.
And that is it's a staggering position to be in, isn't it? That's something that's supposedly as well respected as The Lancet is still pushing this narrative. But I mean, it sums up the situation over here entirely. Being on the ground over here and seeing still the reaction from medical professionals within our nationalised public health service, the NHS, and also the fallout from Pace trial has implications over here with fibromyalgia. It has implications with Ehlers-Danlos syndromes, and to see the dogmatic, willful ignorance still surrounding it is quite staggering. But I mean, as you pointed out, the media play a large part in this, and I've spent a lot of my time trying to debunk and piece together what the Science Media Centre, that the PR kind of agency for the industry over here, is doing by seeding stories. But I think you're right.
Yes, they're an interesting batch. Not that you have any strong feelings about any of this, I see.
No, I'm completely placid about the whole situation, David, obviously. It's an awful wonder to behold, seeing this play out in the UK. It's quite staggering, and your work on this.
What's interesting for me, and I think what has been, I find this all very astonishing. I find the report, I find the science astonishing. I find the Science Media Center incredible. I find the way the journals refuse to make changes astonishing. I find the way the journalists, parrot whatever the Science Media Center says to be astonishing. The whole thing to me is astonishing. It's not what I learned, you know, as a journalist, you know, and not that I didn't study journalism. It's not what I learned when I was practicing, you know, as a newspaper reporter, or what I do in my current journalism either. And it's not what I learned as a public health master's student and then, a doctoral student to how to behave as a public health person. I don't understand, you know, when you're a journalist, you learn, you make a mistake, you correct it right away. If someone tells you you made a mistake, you tell your editor. If you notice it yourself, you tell your editor. You know, you don't like it, but that's what you're supposed to do. These people seem to behave in different ways. They make mistakes, and then they don't think it's necessary to correct them, or they don't think it's necessary to actually, you know, present things in a truthful way. I have found the responses of the PACE authors, you know, to their concerns to be full of inaccuracies, untruths, misrepresentations of other people's arguments, straw person arguments. I mean, they just don't have any responses. And usually when people can't respond to something, it's because there's no really legitimate, acceptable answer, and that's the case with the PACE study. I really don't understand it, but it does seem that it is part of a whole strategy to get a lot of people with illnesses that Simon Wesley doesn't understand or Michael Sharp doesn't understand and get those people into cognitive behavior therapy. You know, that seems to be a lot of what is going on when you put all these illnesses and this category of, you know, medically unexplained symptoms, and then they all have to go through the improving access to psychological therapies program, you know, because they have something that some GP, general practitioner, or some psychiatrist doesn't understand. I find that kind of scary. That's happening, you know, the system, in the U.S., you know, it's horrible that we don't have a healthcare system. On the other hand, we don't have a healthcare system, so everybody, I mean, we do sort of, I'm being a little facetious, but basically we don't have sort of federalized control in a way that would sort of mandate treatment for everybody to get cognitive behavior therapy and graded exercise therapy. So if you have decent health insurance, you know, you can probably find a doctor, maybe find a doctor who at least will give you some better management or have the possibility of that. In the UK, it's like everybody seems dominated by this one paradigm and nobody seems able to offer anything else.
No, you're spot on. And you've actually hit the nail on the head there. It's a terrible situation, really, because on the one hand, yeah, in the UK, we are in some respects extremely lucky to have the NHS, the public health service, and it's wonderful if you have cancer, brilliant if you have leukemia, wonderful if you have all manner of other issues. If you're chronically ill with a multi-systemic disease or illness, the NHS is absolutely appalling over here. And as you say, because it's in your words.
I think that's a really good observation, because I certainly don't want to be dissing on the idea that everybody should have access to healthcare. And I think what happens in these kinds of situations, it seems to me, is that for people who have standard, regular things that everybody knows how to deal with, you have a this, you have a that, and you have to get, you know, there's a clear protocol and there's a clear understanding of what's the best treatment, then you get that. That's great. You get it without insurance. That's your insurance. You know, here you have to jump through all sorts of things. And I'm sure other there you have to jump through hoops about timing and waiting if it's elective surgery and all that. So here it's really just a have and have nots. If you have money, you have access to good insurance. You have access to a good job and good insurance. And if you don't, you don't. And so then you're out on your own. And if you have access to good insurance, you have a bit more flexibility than in the UK to seek out alternative people and somehow, somewhat get it covered. It's certainly not absolute, and many people will tell you that's not the case for them, and it's gotten much harder, and so on and so forth, and all that sort of stuff. But there is some possibility for that in the US, and I don't know how it is in other systems. So, you know, but it's really, I can also understand why it's hard for a system to sort of accommodate the kinds of illnesses that people are experiencing, because it does cost a lot of money, and it is, you know, there are resources and so on and so forth. So I can sort of understand if you're a bureaucrat looking at it in a simplified way, and that's what you do. But of course, it's terrible from an overall public health perspective, and it's terrible for the people who are in that situation, and why should they be the ones to suffer?
Yeah, absolutely, and you're quite right. I mean, it is a conundrum, if you like, the sort of chronic illness. I say it's an epidemic, the chronic illness epidemic that is sweeping the world, especially for countries which have public nationalized healthcare. And it is a conundrum in this country because, I mean, for me, I say the same thing a lot. Essentially, what we have with the NHS is the same model that it essentially was, apart from some tweaking to make it more of a corporate marketplace. We still have the same model as it was in the early 1950s when it first properly came into fruition. That is, people go in at one end ill and are supposed to come out the other end healthy or dead. And there's no middle ground. It lacks a holistic approach for the complexities of 21st century chronic illness. And it's just not designed to deal with it. I mean, in the UK, you have ME patients whose medical folders are full of going from department to department to department to department within the same hospital, and no one giving them any answers. And that's what's so lacking. But again, we're back to what you also spoke about, which is post-trial. And there is, because of the fact that the government controls both the NHS and the Department for Work and Pensions, our social security arm of the government over here, because it controls all of this, it therefore controls exactly what goes on. And people like Sir Simon Wesley are deeply embedded in government. I mean, he recently did the review of our mental health legislation, even though his name is mud in a lot of circles. Of course, this is a fair and balanced podcast, and I will, of course, be giving Sir Simon Wesley the right of reply to my accusations. But this is the challenge. I mean, the people involved in PACE in this country are so embedded in government that you find it, the lines are completely blurred.
Well, I think there's a. Well, I wanted to say one thing. I mean, at least this has nothing to do with ME or anything else. But at least, you know, you do have a country that does nominally believe that people have a right to have access to health care. So I live in a country where every day the president is chipping away at that. I mean, you know, we sort of enshrined that belief, you know, when they finally passed, you know, Affordable Care Act under Obama. And, you know, now we're going the other way, and every possible opportunity that's being chipped away at. So that's horrible. But in terms of the I forget, what was the other point we were making?
The fact that our governments basically control the health service, and therefore it's kind of like a whim to them, really, what they put into it. And it kind of, for me, played into your point about how at least you have choice in America.
I think, you know, systems just don't like ambiguity. It's like the stock market doesn't like when there's chaos and what's going to happen. Everybody likes predictability. With illnesses like ME, it's unpredictable. You know, the long-term course is unclear. Nobody quite knows, you know, what it is. So it's understandable that bureaucracies are going to have a challenging time at best, dealing with that when they're used to dealing with X. And really all I'm trying to do, in a way, I'm not a political scientist. I'm not a bureaucrat. I'm lucky I don't have to figure those things out. All I'm trying to do is say you cannot based public health policy on these ridiculous, stupid, anti-scientific studies. And, you know, that's really what I see my function is in this whole kind of thing. I'm not really the one to say, oh, you have to put all your money into pursuing the mitochondrial, this and that. I'm not the one to say, these are the best social programs to, you know, or anything like that. That's not my job. My job is to sort of basically say, hey, I've kind of looked at these studies, and they talk to a lot of people, and just when you look at what studies, these don't really hold up, you know, and trying to do that in all the ways I can and communicate that widely through, say, open letters or sending a letter and then CCing different people in the ways that I can sort of appropriately raise concerns, that seems to be my function.
No, absolutely. And it's a crucial part in all this. If you need to take a break to grab yourself a tea, coffee, water, or you just need to relax your ears for a few minutes, then take some time now, because we will be back in a few seconds. The other sort of element of PACE trial over here is is the it has much more broader implications in terms of a sort of separate agenda that is going on almost extra governmentally, in terms of this the whole notion of post trial in the sense that cognitive behavioral therapy, talking therapy, and graded exercise therapy should make people living with ME better. It's part of a far wider agenda of, since 2008, welfare, social security reform in this country, and effectively pushing sick and disabled people back into as much employment they can do as possible. And post trial was one of the beginnings of that within the social security system. And we're now seeing exactly the same thing. We're seeing the same thing happening now, for example, with postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. There's evidence coming out that they are now planning to give cognitive behavioral therapy as a standard treatment for orthostatic intolerance. And the same thing's happening with musculoskeletal diseases. Cognitive behavioral therapy is being pushed for those as well. So it's a systematic effort by our subsequent governments over here. And it's all part of pushing as many sick and disabled people off welfare, off Social Security, and back into work. And that's where post trial, for me, came into that broader agenda, if you like.
Well, you know, that's a very, you know, I mean, I've certainly read those, that stuff, and I it certainly seems very plausible to me, and it seems, looking at it from the outside, I can't disagree with that as an interpretation of it, although I can't say, you know, myself whether that's in fact, you know, what's going on. No, I will say that one of the things I do want to say is that what I had meant was trying to think about before was that Brian Hughes, the psychologist, the Irish psychologist, who wrote a book about, you know, all the problems in psychology, and then had a whole section on how PACE manifested all of them, all the problems in psychological research, and that how PACE really manifested all of them. He also coined, or, you know, used in a phrase, eminence-based medicine, which I thought was a really wonderful phrase, and I was jealous that I didn't think of it myself, because basically we all talk about evidence-based medicine, and evidence-based medicine is like, you know, what it sounds like. It's based on, you know, evidence. And so what used to happen in medical journals is that doctors, you know, an expert in some field would write, you know, some sort of narrative review of the literature. And so basically that person would read this and that, and, you know, just kind of based on their own interpretation of everything, say, well, this is what I think, you know, and this is what the literature says, but it wouldn't be systematic at all. And then we came up with sort of systematic reviews, like with the Cochrane or that kind of thing, that or meta-analyses that purported to sort of get around the problem of just an individual clinician making up their own mind based on their misinterpretation of the data. But now we see from Cochrane that you can also basically misinterpret the whole body of research and come up with reviews that then can be used to sort of justify, you know, well, this research wasn't great, the PACE raw, but look at Cochrane, it sort of ratifies it after the fact. So there's a lot of problems in these things all the way through. But one of the things that Brian Hughes said that I liked was this concept of so basically you would say because the PACE trial, you know, sort of passed peer review and it was, you know, considered to be a good trial and it was reviewed in the Lancet and then it, you know, whatever, and it, all this sort of stuff. And then with Cochrane, that's evidence-based medicine. But Brian Hughes used the idea of eminence-based medicine to suggest that basically the reason why this research passed all these supposed evidence-based tests, like Cochrane, is that there was so much sort of deference and kind of, you know, deference really given to people at the helm who are distinguished professors and sit on review panels and are sort of known. And of course, their research must be good because their previous research has been so published, and this is all based on previous things. And in fact, you know, that's. So really the research and the respect that has been given PACE is not based on the study itself. The study is a piece of garbage or piece of crap or whatever it is, and warrants being torn up at conferences, as I've done a couple of times. It's not based on anybody who actually, you know, they claim that it's good research, but it isn't. It's terrible research. So basically it's based on the fact that Simon Wesley claims it's a thing of beauty, and poor Michael Sharp, you know, feels beleaguered because people are pointing out that his, you know, what he spent 30 years of his life on is bogus. So I understand why he feels bad. Too bad for him. I'm sorry for him about that. But that doesn't warrant continuing to claim that a study in which participants could be recovered on key measures at baseline is a good study. And they keep claiming the same thing over and over and over again. And ultimately, if the decisions finally are based on the science and not on eminence-based science, but on evidence-based science, the evidence will show that they're wrong and that the patients have been right from the beginning. And that in coming in and rallying scientists, you know, to weigh in, I was also right. And they are wrong. The Lancet's wrong. And yes, it's all they're all supporting each other in sort of a mass delusion, as far as I can tell.
No, and I mean, yeah, you hit the nail on the head with the, when you say about deference. I mean, and this is the problem. Sir Simon Wesley, I mean, he's a sort of pillar of the medical community in this country. And I think there must be elements of the fact that if Paige Trial over here was actually exposed for the fraudulent nonsense it is, then, I mean, it would cast shadows of doubt across the entire sort of psychiatry industry in the UK.
Let me just say one thing. I have, you know, I torn it up in public to Paige Trial. I have said I think it's a possible, you know, thing of research misconduct. I would meet some of the thresholds for me. I'm not going to be the one, you know, to call it fraud. So I just want to say that.
That's fine. I happily do.
I'm not going to disagree. I'm not going to disagree. You know, someone has to look at that. I'm not a lawyer who looks at fraud. You know, I think there's certainly questions about whether these £5 million were spent well and were spent honestly. So, you know, I think there are questions of research integrity involved. You know, but I do think it's also just, you know, really it should not have been approved from the beginning. I think patients were right from the beginning to point out the problem. So we didn't actually really need to spend the £5 million and all this to know that this was going to be a problem. It sort of turned out the way one might have predicted it. And, you know, again, I think that, you know, Professor Sharp and the other people want to think that there's a, quote, campaign against the Paige Trial. And my feeling is, of course there is. It's a terrible trial. Why wouldn't there be a campaign for people to point out, I'm not, you know, a, quote, campaign, that's not, you know, that people are trying to point out that it's not a good trial. When you start accusing anybody who opposes or criticizes the trial as being part of an unfair campaign, you know, then you start sounding ridiculous. When you start accusing, you know, there was a journal, you accuse every in the Journal of Health Psychology and the editor and everybody involved in the journal as part of the campaign and everybody who wrote commentaries. Apparently all the 100-plus experts who signed the last open letter to The Lancet saying the Paige trial had unacceptable methodological lapses. This includes my colleagues at Berkeley and this is people at Harvard and Columbia and University, you know, whoever, in the UK and many more in the US. They're all part of a campaign. Apparently, because they said something that Michael Sharp didn't like. They're part of a campaign in favor of good science and against bad science, and Paige's bad science. That's why 114 experts signed the open letter. You know, that's why almost all the patient organizations are against it, not because they're crazy hysterical patients, but because they recognize bad science when they see it.
No, absolutely. And I mean, when you put it in those terms, it's completely down the rabbit hole stuff. It really is that, as you say, 114 eminent scientists, people from Berkeley, people from Stanford, they're all obviously crazy and, as you put, hysterical. And it's some sort of organized smear campaign when it's just actually people speaking out on behalf of good science. I mean, I wanted just moving on slightly from Paige Trial. I'm interested in your thoughts on a lot of things, but I'm quite interested in your thoughts on other research that's out there. I mean, we as a community and as a disease, ME, there's constant new bits of research coming out. I mean, obviously, the latest one is the nanoelectronics that's come out of Stanford. For me, there's been some interesting stuff. There was a sort of amalgamation of research about two-day cardiopulmonary exercise testing with regards to post-exertional malaise. There's stuff going on with advanced flow cytometry testing. I mean, is there any research that you've come across recently which has kind of piqued your interests in terms of ME? Anything that stood out for you?
Well, so, you know, the Stanford research certainly got a lot of attention. And I think that was very interesting, and I'm very interested to see what happens next. I think the Science Media Center put out a couple of statements, and one of them was from Chris Ponting, and I, you know, who now runs the CFSME Research Collaborative, and I thought he put out a very positive but cautious statement that, you know, look, this is interesting, and I'll be curious to see. I mean, I don't remember exactly what he said, but more or less, yeah, let's just a serious look, and let's see what happens next, and they you know, they need to confirm it. Simon Westley put out a sort of snitty or kind of peevish sounding kind of thing, but, well, you know, it just sounded tough. I didn't really understand what his tone was about, rather than just saying, hey, you know, whatever, this isn't interesting, or this is interesting, or they need to do a lot more work, which is sort of what he's, you know, basically he sort of dismissed it without actually dismissing it. I do think that calling something a biomarker is probably not the best thing in a headline. You know, I don't think that, I think when people hear biomarker, they hear all sorts of expectations about what that means and what the timeline is and biomarker identified, and it really is, you know, perhaps a potential, you know, a potential biomarker at some point in the future, or it's an extremely, you know, because basically, it, you know, we don't know if it distinguishes between people with ME and people with other illnesses. It seems to distinguish between healthy people, these healthy controls in their small study, and people with ME, or people with ME-CFS, or whatever it is we're calling it, or people with one part of the cluster of things that we're calling that. So let's, but, you know, that's very interesting, but it's not sufficient to really be a biomarker that's going to be very useful.
Yeah, no, that was kind of, that's my position on it as well. Until they can show that it wasn't just for people who are ill versus, as you say, people who are healthy, then I think it was a proceed with caution, however interesting it was. There's nothing to
find. I think sometimes researchers, and I think sometimes there may not be enough communication between researchers and their universities, you know, media offices, because I don't think really that putting me, I think, you know, if you actually read some of the comments from the researchers, they were much more measured what was in the article written by the media office than the use of the term biomarker found, which is essentially what the headline more or less said, would suggest to many people reading it, especially reporters who then translate that to the larger world. As, you know, researchers claim they found a biomarker. Well, they didn't actually claim they found a biomarker. I haven't read the study, and I'm talking about, if you even look at the article from the media office, the researchers were not firmly claiming that they found a biomarker. The headline overstated that, I think, and I think that, you know, one needs to be cautious about that.
Yeah, no, I agree absolutely. And I mean, the most telling thing about that was, if you actually did read the research in full, the claims of Simon Westley, and I think, I can't remember the guy's name, but another doctor from the University of Edinburgh, who was saying, oh, well, they don't know this and they don't know that. These guys, the guys from the research at Stanford admitted all the flaws in what they'd done and that more things needed to be done. But as you point out quite rightly, it was over-egged slightly by the media. I mean, I'm interested, and I did ask your permission to ask you this, because again, I'm always interested in people's thoughts, and it's just your opinion. You're not a clinician, you're not a professional researcher as such, but when it comes to ME, I mean, what's your kind of gut feeling on what you think it really is, or do you have an idea of what you think it is, where the cause actually lies with this disease that we've been going around the houses for decades and decades?
Well, okay, so it does seem to me like it seems to be triggered or has some infectious disease process going on, whether that's, I don't know that I think that's ongoing, but that there's obviously something that for most people, you know, not to discount the people who are gradual onset, maybe they had a subclinical infectious episode, they don't remember, whatever, but it seems like most people report that. So that seems fairly clear. It seems to be definitely something going weird, you know, with the immune system, there definitely seems to be something. I mean, these are all just, you know, basic things and nothing very intelligent. But, you know, people do seem to, you know, the idea that there's something going on in the mitochondria seems to me interesting and very possible and, you know, whatever. There also does seem to be indications of some inflammation in the brain, although I gather that's not, you know, it's hard to show that, and I gather that's not fully clear, and maybe not clear at all, but there does seem to be some sort of inflammatory process. It also seems clear that people can get this from any number of triggers, not just an infectious illness, but maybe a mold exposure, or maybe some other toxic exposure, or maybe any insult to the system, which does leave it open to like a hyper-stress response. So that seems to be something that possibly could trigger it without then having to reduce that to saying it's a, quote, psychological illness or it's just stress-based. You know, stress is also a stress on the system. So those things all seem to cluster to say there's definitely something going on here. Now, whether they're all related or whether, you know, they're all different, you know, or slightly different, I always have a question as to why that, you know, why is it, you know, why have we noticed it in outbreaks, you know, and now it doesn't seem, you know, now it hasn't occurred lately in outbreaks. It occurs in, you know, what we call, you know, sporadic cases. That sporadic
doesn't mean... interesting point, yeah.
You know, sporadic doesn't mean very rare. It just means not in a recognized pattern, right? So I don't understand all those things. And in a way, I'm in a lucky position with regards to this disease because I don't have to. You know, that's not what I'm doing, really. I don't have to. I can say, well, this is interesting, that's interesting, but I don't really have to weigh in on that or really feel like it's necessary for me to have really strong opinions about those things that are, you know, because that's not really what I'm doing. I'm looking at science that I can take apart and say, hey, this doesn't make any sense to me. And when I talk to experts, it also does, you know, experts beyond that I have a public health understanding and, a sub-doctoral, I guess, understanding of epidemiology in these things. I don't have a doctoral level because I'm not an epidemiologist. You know, so that I'm pointing out things that I find wrong with the study. So far, none of them are really refuted. So I think I have a good track record with these people who claim to be experts. Now, if we want to go look at what, you know, just the last week, now I'm arguing with people who, you know, there's a whole argument about how much these, quote, medically unexplained symptoms cost the National Health Service in the UK, right? So there was a study done in 2010, and that found that of the middle-aged population, of the amount spent on people identified as having, quote, medically unexplained symptoms among the working age population in England, the money spent on them counts for 10% of the NHS budget for people of working age. Okay? That has gotten interpreted in a lot of the literature on MUS and on the Improving Access to Psychological Therapies program as 10% of all NHS budget, the entire NHS budget, is spent on people with MUS. That's a really like three times inflation of what the actual study showed. Like putting aside for a minute, if you believe in MUS, like you don't have to argue about does MUS exist, is it just a stupid category, or was this study well done in calculating the cost? The study found one thing. The people who were promoting this concept of MUS and how much it cost the NHS are using a figure allegedly citing that, but repeatedly over the last 10 years, citing a figure that's actually dramatically bigger, which makes the cost, it makes it even much more imperative that we have to get the cost of treating supposedly MUS under control. So basically, then when you point this out to the journal, you know, so far I pointed out to a couple of authors and a journal editor, and they just don't seem to think it's something they have to change. They don't want to change it. It's like, you made a mistake, you need to correct it. The journal editor wrote back to me and said, oh, can you send us a short sentence or two and we'll consider if we want to publish it. I wrote back and said, well, usually you make a correction by working with the authors who made the mistake and you correct your own mistake. You know, I'm not going to send you any, I don't have to send you any letter or sentences for consideration in your journal in order for you to do your job as an editor, or I shouldn't have to send in anything. I'm pointing out the mistake. I've documented the mistake. Do your job. Fix the mistake. But they don't want to, so they don't. That's incredible to me. As a journalist and as a public health professional, I find it hard to believe that you point out an actual mistake and they just, you know, it's like the President Trump. They're like President Trump. You point out that 3 million people did not actually vote illegally for Hillary in the U.S., and he just repeats the same thing. No, they did not vote. These people are in a way similar to that. They sort of can't seem to bring themselves to acknowledge, you know, we made a mistake, and yeah, it you know, we're putting out information in the professional public health literature or medical literature, and we actually want it to be accurate, so we better change the false information that we put in our article and that we published.
The Trump analogy is a brilliant one. It's exactly that kind of willfully ignorant behavior. Absolutely, I think it's spot on. Sort of to sum up, really, to finish off, what was it about Pauschal and Emmy that sort of sparked you to go on this? It's almost a crusade against it. Was it the fact that it was such bad science?
I don't want to call it a crusade, because basically I'm a public health professional, and I've been a journalist for many years, and so I've done a lot of investigative journalism. And so this is my investigative journalism and public health project. It's not a crusade. If it's a crusade, it's against bad science that's being used to influence public health policy. It's not a crusade against PACE. It's not a crusade against an individual. This is really bad science, and I've documented that it's bad science, and these people keep insisting that it's good science, and they keep insisting that it should impact policy that then impacts patients. And there's a good argument that graded exercise therapy in particular is harmful to people, potentially harmful to patients, who report, overwhelmingly in surveys that it is. There's a good chance that, trying to persuade people that they have unhelpful illness beliefs when they actually have realistic illness beliefs about having an organic illness, from my perspective, is arguably quite unethical. So I do see these as, these are questions of current public health of concern. They're not sort of academic and theoretical, and I'm not on a sort of personal hobby horse. I've talked to so many people who feel harmed by this body of, quote, evidence, and by these what I consider members of the ideological brigade who push for something where there's really no decent evidence to support it. So how did I get into this, I think, was the question. I went on a long whatever. I had a friend who got sick many years ago. Then I was covering it. I wrote a lot about XMRV, the mouse retrovirus, 8 or 9 years ago when they thought it was that. PACE trial was published during that. I wrote a couple of articles, one bad. Then I wrote another article about case definition. The PACE authors asked for a correction. That didn't make me happy. We ended up having an exchange of letters in the New York Times about case definition. And I thought at the time, well, there's something. They're making claims that don't seem right. Then I started reading patients' commentaries, and at first I thought it can't be possible that people could be in a recovered zone at baseline. I mean, it's just what I was reading in the patient stuff at some point seemed not really realistic. It wasn't possible that someone could publish the paper that did that. And then when I actually looked at the paper, in fact, that was all the things that patients were saying was true. So that's when I got interested in it. And the reason I've kept at it really is if they, I didn't intend to. It's just that they've kept insisting that up is down and black is white. And as I've said, I get very passionate about it, I guess. But part of it is that, like, I can't believe, 62 years old, and I'm a very robust, healthy 62-year-old without ME. And they've driven me kind of a little bit nuts with their gaslighting, with insisting up is down and black is white. And no, it doesn't matter if you're recovered on an outcome measure at baseline, because we have other outcome measures anyway. That's not science. So I do get driven a little bit, upset by the claims that they're making, and I get a little, overwrought sometimes. But I just find it hard to believe. And so part of what keeps me going is that they keep doing things that I find. They did what? They said what? I can't believe it. I can't believe that an editor would write to me and say, well, if you want to send me a couple of letters, and he also said, well, the data, this is related to MUS. He said, the data are 10 years old. Do you really think it's worth it to bother correcting it? And I'm like, well, it was just cited in your journal 2 years ago. It wasn't too old for that. Now it's too old to bother correcting them. Is there a statute of limitations on when you have to correct data? I mean, I've never heard of an editor, not wanting to make a correction because something's too old. That's not proper editing. It's not professional. It's very unprofessional, especially when you're putting out information in the public sphere that is used to, in this case, treat patients with a serious illness.
No, absolutely.
With MUS, whatever that is.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a brilliant, brilliant summing up of why you do this. And as you say, I mean, there's so many people who have reportedly been harmed by this. And I think, David, I know you have an awful lot of respect from the community and certainly from myself and a lot of people I know. And I mean, I find your work fantastic and inspirational. How you are, you're indefatigable, I'm trying to say, very late at night in the UK after a long day, the word got there in the end. But it has been a real pleasure to speak to you, and all the details of where people can find out more information about the work you're doing will of course be in the show notes to this. David Tuller, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's very much appreciated.
Thanks, Steve. Good to talk to you. Bye.
Thank you. I would like to thank all my guests on this week's podcast. You can find more details about them in the individual show notes from each episode. I would also like to thank the ME Action Network. You can follow them on Twitter. It's at ME Act Net. And the UK group is ME Act Net UK. Of course, thank you to the ME Association as well. You can follow them on Twitter. It's at ME Association. And there are full details of all the activities these organisations are doing in the show notes. And last but not least, thank you to all the people living with ME, their families, friends, advocates and supporters out there. Society may have made you invisible, but trust me, you are not. You are very much visible. Keep fighting. Until next time, I will see you very soon.
The answer, my friend.